Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, a new rainbow warrior takes to the seas.
Yeah, we've tried to make it as green as possible. We have a lot of grey and black water storage area. The biggest green aspect of the ship is the unique sailing characteristics of it.
Also, fish versus energy. It's become a simmering dispute between countries that share the Mekong River.
We need to clearly assess how much we can gain from a dam and how much we shall lose.
And we drop in on a rescue centre for storks in Cambodia.
We have the male who's actually standing in front of us right at the moment now, and he's looking a little bit perturbed as to us being here.
Those stories coming up. I'm Nathan Whitcomb. Welcome to the show. It's hard to think of a single craft that's done as much for the environmental movement as the Rainbow Warrior. The Greenpeace flagship's swashbuckling adventures have courted controversy and shined a light on environmental abuses for nearly three decades. Along the way, it's been rammed, raided, and bombed, and it's raised plenty of attention in the process. Of course, it hasn't really been one boat since the first vessel was famously sunk in an act of sabotage in the 1980s. Last week, the Rainbow Warrior 3 was launched in Germany, following the retirement of its predecessor in August. Jonathan Gifford was in Hamburg this weekend to pay it a visit on its first port of call.
The sun was out and Hamburg's historic port was buzzing. So it shouldn't come as much of a surprise that the Rainbow Warrior 3 drew big crowds in her first open boat day.
Welcome on board the new Rainbow Warrior 3 here in Hamburg in the heart of the city.
Greenpeace's latest high-tech purpose-built boat is the third version of the Rainbow Warrior. The first was famously bombed by French agents before it could set off to disrupt nuclear tests in 1985. Ship's cook Rien Achterberg was aboard that fateful night that cost one of his colleagues, a photographer, his life.
Well, people were really pissed off about it. And of course it was worldwide news. It went worldwide, the whole thing. So it was very upsetting. And it was the saying, hey, you can't sink a rainbow. Yeah? We still went, we did it, we got a new Rainbow Warrior, and now we got number three. Yes, cool, this is how cool. Yeah, we have a history, and that should never have happened. But on the other hand, because that happened, our support just grew enormously, worldwide.
The new Rainbow Warrior cost 23 million euros to build, and it's a far cry from the original converted fishing trawler that Greenpeace bought for £40,000 back in the 70s to take on whalers. Captain Joel Stewart says the new 58-metre boat uses a combination of high and low-tech solutions to keep it leaner and greener.
Yeah, we've tried to make it as green as possible. We have a lot of grey and black water storage area. We do have very good sewage treatment. We also have EcoSpeed paint, anti-fouling paint on the bottom. It doesn't use toxic chemicals. The biggest green aspect of the ship is the unique sailing characteristics of it.
Designed from scratch as a hybrid sail electric and diesel propelled craft, the Rainbow Warrior 3 has the potential to carry its 30-person crew long distances on limited fuel and at 14 or 15 knots to do so pretty quickly as well. Like Rainbow Warriors of old, the plan is for this new craft to be deployed at short notice. Christian Bussau is the team leader of the Rapid Response Unit here in Germany.
Let's say the following example. We get now the information that in the North Sea there's a problem with another ship who is leaking oil in the North Sea. We will send the Rainbow Warrior out there. Then when we are at the near of the spot, the inflatables will go in the water with the activist. We will get in contact with the ship. We will ask, do you need help? Where's the problem? Can we do something? We will try to help there to get the oil out of the water. This is rapid response, and everything like this is possible with the Rainbow Warrior, but a lot more.
Directly protesting oil spills and whale hunts at sea may be what made Greenpeace's name last century, but today's environmental issues pose a new set of challenges.
Of course, in the history, the problems were really black and white, and nowadays we don't have the problems as easy as they were in the past.
Sailing into restricted areas to obstruct nuclear tests in the Pacific or filming the harpooning of whales or the dumping of radioactive waste at sea is simple compared to galvanising people to take action on Greenpeace's number one environmental concern, climate change.
And this is also the reason why Greenpeace will work in the next 3 years in the Arctic to show that to the public how big the problem already is. The problems are, let's say, are becoming more difficult for us to work on. But what has not changed is the mood of the Greenpeace activist. On this ship, there's the same type of activists like we had in the past. Young people who want to do something, who want to change something, and who want to bear witness at the spots where the problems are.
Greenpeace, like its new boat, may be more professional, slicker, shinier, and facing a more complex set of problems than in its youth, but the spirit on board remains the same. And Achterberg says confronting environmental problems at sea can also be a lot of fun.
It becomes a Greenpeace love boat. We like to make love, not war. Yeah? That's why I don't sail anymore, because they started the woman aboard started calling me granddad. That's depressing, eh? But yeah, we rely on the volunteers. And it's great to see a bunch of people for the first time come to a ship like this and be able to even sail on it. That's a privilege.
So as the Rainbow Warrior makes its way around European ports before heading off on its next campaign, a new crew is coming together to find ways to tackle the environmental challenges of a new century. Jonathan Gifford for Deutsche Welle Radio, Hamburg.
We're going to turn our attention to the UK now, where a new way of calculating land use suggests that Europe is the continent most dependent on imported land. According to a study, 60% of the land Europe needs for its food, fuel and clothes comes effectively from overseas. The research was commissioned by the environmental group Friends of the Earth. It warns that Europe's land footprint will have to reduce drastically over the next few years as developing nations demand more of their own terrain for domestic consumption. Nick Martin reports from Bedfordshire in the UK.
If only Britain's got most of their meat and poultry from places like this. Watergate Farm, just 50 kilometres north of London, rears turkeys that are mostly sold to local butchers or to consumers direct. Alice Hunt joined the family farm after studying agriculture at university.
All the turkeys are sold very locally, either straight off the farm to households or via local butchers. Although we keep them, well, it's quite large scale, we keep a lot of turkeys. There's free range in barns, sort of freshly strawed every day. They have access outside, sort of for areas that they can sort of wander. And that's sort of our philosophy behind it. They're sort of kept well. And, you know, you do maybe pay a sort of a premium price for them, but you sort of pay for what you get.
The need for more locally produced food is just one of the recommendations from Friends of the Earth, following the publication of a new report about Europe's insatiable appetite for other countries' land. The environment group suggests that the UK alone increased its total land use by 16% between 1997 and 2004, well above the rate of population growth. Kenneth Richter from Friends of the Earth says Europe's land needs are off the scale.
What this research has shown is that Europe is more dependent on land overseas, on imported land, than any other region in the world. The average person in the UK is using four times as much land as the average person, say, in India or China, for example. And this has significant impacts on the ability of people in poor countries or in your communities where this land is taken away from food production, and this has an impact on the ability of those communities to feed themselves.
It's the first time research has focused on land use rather than the volume of exports. The data shows that Europe uses 640 million hectares of land a year, the equivalent of 1.5 times its own area of land. While the campaign group accepts that exports to Europe are hugely beneficial for developing nations, researchers say it also leads to land grabbing and the loss of control over natural resources. Most of Europe's foreign land use is from China, the Russian Federation, Brazil and Argentina. The figures go up to 2004, the date for which the most recent data is available, but further increases in Europe's land footprint are expected to show up from the last 7 years, especially with the rise of crops for biofuels.
Europe has unsustainably high targets for the use of biofuels. There isn't enough agricultural land in Europe, so most of this is imported from overseas. Lots of research has shown that these biofuels have very limited role in actually reducing our impact on the climate. Therefore, it doesn't make sense to import large amounts of biofuels from overseas. So we want these targets to be scrapped because we don't think they play a helpful role against climate change.
Friends of the Earth now wants the EU to take up the mantle and start measuring trends in land use. The environment campaigner warns that Europe must reduce its land footprint by relying less on imported feed for cattle.
Another area is meat and the fact that we're importing massive amounts of soy from South America to feed our cows and pigs in big factory farms in Europe. What we would like to see is to feed these animals on homegrown feeds. People need to eat less meat but better quality meat and meat fed on domestic feedstocks.
Here in Bedfordshire, Watergate Farm is showing in a small way what could be possible if the UK reduced its reliance on foreign land use. Alice Hunt says that that would lead to less corporate farming, which means higher quality produce, which European consumers will have to be prepared to pay more for.
People like it, they can come to the farm, see where they're reared, see where they've been produced, and buy them straight from the farmer. And we can guarantee that if you taste one of our turkeys compared to a, frozen turkey, you will 100% taste the difference. Food is pumped with all this chemicals, water that we don't even realise. I think people are starting to realise that and are turning back to the locally produced sort of family farm food.
The EU is looking at a 2-year consultation to decide targets for resource use, convincing the broader public, from consumers to large suppliers, to pay the full costs of their land use may take a little longer. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle, Bedfordshire.
Staying in Europe, in Italy, rainstorms in the country's north left at least 9 people dead this week. As Megan Williams reports, many say the severity of the floods could have been avoided if Italian law were enforced.
It started off as a thunderstorm and within hours led to rivers of water rushing through small towns in northern Italy and pulling down whole hillsides of mud. The northern coastal town of Liguria has been hardest hit, with at least 2 of the 5 heritage Cinque Terre villages now isolated as a result of roads being washed away. Rivers of mud poured through the once picturesque villages of Vernazza and Monterosso. The mayor of Monterosso said the fishing village has been effectively wiped out. Experts say global climate change is provoking the downpours, but they also say deaths and billions of euros of damage could be avoided if Italy cracked down on overbuilding and disregard for Italian laws preventing construction on hillsides. Geologist Francesco Russo says things are getting worse and worse in Italy, the European country with the highest risk of landslides, with 10% of its territory in danger of shifting. Russo says there's no legal or financial motivation for prevention and much reward for responding to emergencies, where special committees of well-paid politicians are set up and private companies win huge contracts for repair and reconstruction.
sono sempre le commissioni tecniche ben pagate.
Maria Teresa Fagioli is the vice president of the Tuscan Geologists Association. She says even the huge amount spent repairing the damage only covers a fraction of the full costs of landslides in Italy.
In the past 20 years, 60 billion estimation of the damage, but we paid and we repair only for 22 billion.
So what happened to the other areas?
We haven't money, so they stay. They stay in this situation.
So towns stay abandoned,
yes,
people leave their homes, and it just stays that way.
Yes, they stay there, and we are searching for new money to repair this damage.
A discouraging scenario for the hundreds now left homeless by the latest downpours here. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
Time now on the show for a quick look at some news from the past week. Here's Kate Laycock.
Eco News. Tens of thousands of residents of the Thai capital Bangkok are using an emergency holiday to flee rising floodwaters. The government announced a 5-day holiday starting this Thursday to give people a chance to leave the city. The country's worst flooding in half a century has killed over 370 people and disrupted the lives of 2.5 million others. The floods have caused billions of dollars of damage. British engineers say a geoengineering project to capture carbon dioxide will be ready to roll out by 2018. The UK's Institution of Mechanical Engineers unveiled a small-scale version of their artificial tree on Wednesday. The machine resembles a tree-sized fly swat and is about 1,000 times more effective at absorbing CO2 than plants. Once absorbed, the CO2 could be stored. Its developers say the device may buy some time in the struggle to deal with climate change, but also caution that it is no silver bullet. Conservationists say a critically endangered species of rhinoceros has been poached to extinction in Vietnam. The Worldwide Fund for Nature said this week that a Javan rhino found dead last year was the last of its kind. The WWF and a rhino monitoring group found that 2 years of dung samples in a Vietnamese reserve all stemmed from the same dead animal. They blamed poachers for its extinction. Some 50 of the animals are still thought to survive in Indonesia. Rhino horn can fetch up to $100,000 per kilo on the black market. And finally, in Bolivia, a 2-month dispute over a development proposal in the Amazon came to an end this week. On Monday, lawmakers passed a bill acceding to protesters' demands to halt construction of a highway through a nature reserve in native territories. Some 2,000 indigenous opponents set out on a march in August that took them 600 kilometres to the capital La Paz. They arrived last week. President Evo Morales bowed to public pressure to cancel the project after meeting with the activists.
Kate Laycock there with the environment news. Well, as we just heard there in the news now, a sad development this week with the announcement that Vietnam has very likely lost a species of rhino for good. We're going to stay in Southeast Asia now to hear from a wildlife rescue centre in Cambodia. Matthew Crawford spoke to Alistair Mould, Deputy Manager of the Angkor Centre for the Conservation of Biodiversity.
So this is our lesser adjutant breeding enclosure. We're actually currently standing outside a subcompartment of the lesser adjutant enclosure. It's 70 by 140 metres with a metal fencing about 2.5 metres high around the side. This nursery area has a female lesser adjutant sitting on the nest, which is raised about 1.5 metres high. And she's actually sitting on 3 lesser adjutants that were hatched approximately 1.5 weeks ago. And we have the male, who's actually standing in front of us right at the moment now, and he's looking a little bit perturbed as to us being here. But he'll be fine. I mean, we're quite some distance now. We're probably about 5 metres away from the nest. Inside the main compartment here, we have 37 individuals in an artificially dug pond area, which we stock with fish and eels, so that the adjutants are able to forage naturally inside this semi-wild enclosure.
Alistair Mould is the Deputy Project Manager here at the Angkor Centre for Conservation of Biodiversity. We're about 30 kilometres north of Angkor Wat, Cambodia's world-famous temple complex. And Alistair, what's happening at the centre today?
At the centre here, we have a number of goals. One of them is, well, the predominant goal is wildlife rescue. We work in close collaboration with government agencies to provide facilities for the confiscated animals that are confiscated within Cambodia. We also have conservation breeding programs, which you can see behind us. We have the Lesser Adjutant Stork, Greater Adjutant Stork, and a number of other projects.
Well, with an enormous wingspan of over 2 metres, the Lesser Adjutant is one of the world's largest storks. Its head and bright yellow neck are bald, which is an adaptation for its life as a scavenger. The Adjutant inhabits wetlands across a wide stretch of Southeast Asia, but the population is in rapid decline. BirdLife International estimates there may be as few as 6,500 individuals left. And what's causing the decline?
Well, largely the decline's being caused by habitat change, but also hunting by people surrounding flooded areas. Quite often individuals are collected from nests when they're very young, juveniles, before they've fledged, and they'll be actually sold. The eggs are also sought after, so quite often locals will maybe raid nests and take their eggs.
And what's the Angkor Centre for Conservation of Biodiversity doing to help the Lesser Adjutant?
We support an initiative which is in the northern plains of Cambodia, where you have quite large areas of flooded forest. In collaboration with government agencies and also the Wildlife Conservation Society, we support a nest protection programme where locals in the area are actually provided with an income to identify nest locations and then also to protect these nest locations once they've identified that there are eggs there. And they'll receive an income for this protection, alternative to the illegal income of selling these eggs, capturing the birds and selling them off into the trade. We also have a very large environmental education program where we're working with local communities, setting up eco-clubs, working on community night shows, teaching them a little bit more about sustainable use in their habitat. And then also the last one is research and in-situ conservation. So we're quite active with a number of student groups in Cambodia and also internationally. We had a German student come recently to study about our elongated tortoises. We're looking at hopefully doing a radio tracking program on those. She's successfully finished that now, so... there's a variety of things that ACCB is involved in.
And how are locals reacting to your education efforts to do with conservation of species here?
We've had a great deal of enthusiasm within the local area. We've been working with 4 local schools now for over 4 years, so there's been quite a lot of build-up to this, and we're now sort of dispersing into the Siem Reap province area, and we've had a lot of encouraging responses. There's a lot of work to be done. It's a very difficult climate in which you're working, where obviously the main source of income here is through agriculture and quite often through detrimental activities such as logging. So yes, there are a lot of challenges to that, because obviously the poverty levels are particularly high in the areas that we're working in. But we do have very good responses from all of the programs. We recently had a Vulture Awareness Day. It was the International Vulture Awareness Day, and we had very positive responses there. So yeah, it's an uphill challenge, but everything has so far been very encouraging.
That was Alistair Mould, Deputy Manager of the Angkor Centre for the Conservation of Biodiversity, speaking there, and the reporter was Matthew Crawford. Finally today, the Mekong River. It's one of the world's last great rivers to escape human interventions on a large scale, possibly because until now its natural flooding has been too valuable for those living along its banks. Today it still provides food, water and work for millions of people in the region. But times are changing and pressure is building to exploit the river for its hydroelectric potential. That spells bad news for many of the river's endemic fish species and the people who depend on them for protein. It also spells a recipe for trouble in a region that's seen its fair share of conflict in recent decades. Charlotte Chelsom-Pill reports.
Mekong is a mother, because who produce all the world, the meal and the fish. Mekong is protein for people. The Mekong is the livelihood.
The Mekong River flows 4,500 kilometres from the mountains of Tibet through Burma, Laos, Thailand and Cambodia before entering the South China Sea in Vietnam. It provides food, water and work for some 60 million people who live along its shores. It's also home to over 1,000 species of fish, including the world's 10 largest freshwater fish. Aviva Imhoff of the International River Network says that when it comes to biodiversity, the Mekong is surpassed only by the Amazon.
It's still one of the last great rivers of the world that is in a mostly natural state. The diversity of species is still, you know, largely intact. And the whole ecosystem is largely intact because there's been so few river interventions until now in the basin.
Excluding oceans, the Mekong River is the largest source of fish in the world. Some 2% of all the world's fish catches come from the Mekong system. All in all, that's about 1.5 million tons of fish, worth about $1 billion a year. So Nam, Deputy Director of the Cambodian Fisheries Administration, says these fish are vital for the region's economy.
Fishery in Cambodia is very important, especially for the livelihood of the poor. More than 75% of the total animal protein come from fish. And fishery employ a lot of people. Every year, officially, 30% of the total population of Cambodia that are involved in fishing and fishery-related activity.
Yet demand for the Mekong's fish has led to overexploitation. It's a spiralling problem. By 2025, some 90 million people are expected to be living along the Mekong, a 50% increase. And it's not the only pressure fish stocks are facing. Demand for energy is also climbing, and damming the river is one of the easiest ways to make electricity. That's an added concern for Eric Barron of the World Fish Centre.
The dams are one of the big risks. They modify the hydrology of the system, and we need to clearly assess how much we can gain from a dam and how much we shall lose in terms of fish production. A natural production that happens without any intervention and that is all free, this becomes lost.
There are currently plans for 11 dams on the lower Mekong. 7 of them will be in Lao. Its government argues that hydroelectric power is a green source of energy that will have less impact on the region than other forms of power plants. Lao has aspirations to become the battery of Southeast Asia and has already signed contracts with Thailand for 90% of the energy it will produce. Downstream, not everyone is so enthusiastic about Lao's ambitions. The Mekong River Commission, founded by Lao, Thailand, Cambodia and Vietnam, was set up to resolve disputes over this key resource peacefully. Next month, it will pronounce on the environmental impact of one of the main dams that Lao is seeking to press ahead with. Lao may choose to ignore the decision. But the Commission also faces a broader problem. According to Kelly Brooks from Oxfam, it doesn't include China.
China has a strategic geographic position. With China being upstream to all of the countries in the MRC, they have the ability to control the flow of the Mekong.
As a transnational institution, it's up to the Mekong River Commission to come up with ways of balancing members' interests in using the river for industrial purposes and protecting the ecosystem. But that's no easy task, says the Mekong River Commission's Jørn Christensen.
Because the region here has a history of conflicts, and say there are still many, many sensitive issues just below the surface. Unless this situation is being managed well, it could turn into becoming a problem.
Charlotte Chelsom-Pill was the reporter there. And that's all for this week. Thanks for tuning in. I hope you liked the show. If you're looking for more of our environment content, come check out the webpage. That's dwworld.de/environment. Till next week, I hope you can join us again. I'm Nathan Whitcup. Bye for now.
My cards are on the table, but the drinks have all run out. There's been some others in this room with me. We're really quite a crowd. It's hard to break it gently, but I really thought it through. We'll be right back.
till it joins me.